Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, click on that Here We Still Stand link. Take you over to the registration page for the live stream Here We Still Stand conference, which is the only Here We Still Stand conference going on. So if you want to join us online, that's the way to do it. You'll get a link sent to you at the appropriate time. Just click it. It's all absolutely free. So go over there, sign up. We'd love to hang out with you virtually. Also, today is a glorious day because now you can get your hands, well, you can do the thing that you need to do to eventually get your hands on Unveiling Mercy. This is Chad's new devotional book, Messing Around in the Hebrew. Now, look, if you're listening to this podcast, we know you like to mess around in the Hebrew already because you're listening to 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. This is 365 days of messing around in the Old Testament, messing around with some Hebrew words, bite size. You can just get a little dose of Hebrew every day for a year. I mean, guys, I'm just trying to push this so Chad doesn't have to do the embarrassing, uncomfortable work of telling you how awesome this would be. But let me just say that, I mean, how many people do you know that wouldn't think this is like the gift that you need to give them? I mean, this Christmas, everyone in your family should be getting Unveiling Mercy 365 days in the Hebrew. That's what you're going to need to do. So Christmas gift solved for everyone you know. It is available for pre-order right now. I will put a link in the show notes. Buy one for you, your mom, your dad, your cousin, all that stuff. It was a lot of work. It's 365 days. So you got to buy it. You just got to do it. I'm not saying
that's a good pitch.
Yeah. Well, I'm not saying that if you don't buy this book, that you won't go to heaven. I'm not saying that, but I am saying, why risk it? Right? Just do it.
Oh yeah, that's perfect. I mean, it is. I will agree with you about one thing. I mean, Christmas. If you're like me, I hate buying gifts. I'm a terrible gift buyer. Yeah. So like, if I find something, it's like, you know what? That'd be a pretty good gift for these two or three people. Well, that's what I get.
It's a gift for all year.
I've just solved the problem for all these people who have trouble buying gifts. There you go.
It is the perfect gift for this. It's a big book for people who don't read a lot.
Yeah.
Because you get to read a little bit. You have a whole year to read this book. It's a book that someone, when they close it at the end of the year, they'll be like, I just read a huge book.
Yeah, you know, it is the longest book I've written, but it didn't feel like it because, yeah, it's all the devotions are short. Yeah. You get a verse, you get the Hebrew word, you get a verse, you get a couple of paragraphs of reflection, meditation, you get a prayer. That's it.
Yeah. Well, its link is in the show notes, or just go over to Amazon, Unveiling Mercy. Check it out. Pre-order is now available. Okay. Well, today is the day. We've been leading up to this moment for quite some time. We have heard this refrain all through Judges when we were in there. This is a time when Israel had no king. And this is about to change. It is time for God to give the people what they want. And what they want is a king, even though it's not what God wants. Here it comes.
Yeah, here it comes. Here he comes. We're going to find out who he is and this mission that he's on. He's out, he's searching for donkeys when he finds a kingdom, which is kind of strange. But yeah, you know, one of the fascinating things about this is I was just trying to look here, and I'm pretty sure that, in fact, I'm 99% sure that the word king, or the verb for to be a king, is not found in chapter 9 of First Samuel, which is kind of strange, you know, because there's all this talk of king in the previous chapter. We do have other words associated with it, like prince. We'll come to that in a minute. But we're leading up to the language of king, which is applied, of course, to Saul and to his successors. But yeah, we had the stage set for us.
Well, first, before we can, you know, anoint this guy king, we have to meet him. We got to know a little bit about him.
Yeah, we got to have a background a little bit.
Yeah, and I'll just tell you up front, guys, not to spoil everything, but these guys are going to like choose a guy that is exactly the sort of guy that you would think someone would choose. That's how you end up with President The Rock. That's how this happens. Like, and this is how, like, what is his, what is he good? Is he good at politics? Is he, I don't know. He's the Rock though.
He's the Rock.
He's huge. He's good looking. That's our guy.
Just look at the guy. I mean, he's got leader written all over him, yeah, right? This is the That's the king.
This is the guy.
King Rock.
And especially if you look, if you're after what they're after, which is like, we need like a warrior king. He's going to take us out into battle. I mean, Saul is like going to check the boxes on this.
Yeah. I mean, they're not looking for a diplomat, right? Nope. They're not looking for somebody who's good with diplomacy, you know, who maybe has a degree, knows a little bit about the law. They're just looking for someone who knows what to do when a sword's in their hand. Okay, so let's jump in here. We first find out a little bit about his family tree. That's the way this chapter opens, 1 Samuel 9. There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Bechorath, the son of Aphiah, the son of a Benjamite, a mighty man of valor. That could also be translated a mighty man of wealth or a mighty man of influence. There's a couple different ways that particular Hebrew word could be translated. So we first of all, we got to deal with the fact that he is from this tribe, the tribe of Benjamin. Now, I know that you've slept probably multiple times, unless you've been listening to 40 minutes like nonstop for the last couple of days, but you probably have slept several times since you heard about what happened to the tribe of Benjamin at the end of the book of Judges. You may remember when we were in those really, really dark chapters toward the end that a particular tribe, I wouldn't say rose to prominence, more like lowered itself to prominence, and that was the tribe of Benjamin, because the horrible situation that happened in Gibeah with the gang rape and the murder and just that whole horrific mess, well, that happened in a town that belonged to the tribe of Benjamin, the same tribe that Saul is from. Now, not only that, Dan, but come to find out, we have to fast forward a little bit to get to this, to the next chapter, but it turns out, guess where Saul's from? Saul's not only from the tribe of Benjamin, but he happens to be from the exact same town where all of this happened at the end of Judges. So if you know that, going in, you might be thinking, I don't know. It seemed like a kind of a strange place to choose a king from. So your doubts may be rising as to his fitness, just simply based upon the tribe that he's from and the town that he's from. But you know, you do need to withhold your judgment. Just because a guy comes from a bad place, or at least a place that has bad connotations, doesn't mean that, you know, he's going to end up being a bad guy.
You mean like Nazareth?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. Yeah. Can anything good come out of Nazareth? Can anything good come out of Gibeah? Well, you know, we'll see. We'll see. We're going to give Saul we're going to put the best construction on Saul. We're going to, you know, see how he does. Now, I will say this as kind of if we want to go back a little bit with regard to the tribe of Benjamin, and I think that we should, because this actually becomes significant. So let's think about Benjamin just for a minute. Benjamin, of course, was one of the sons of Jacob. So you got to go all the way back to the book of Genesis for this. And if you remember, Jacob had two wives, two co-wives, and he had sons with every single one of these. And Benjamin was, along with Joseph, these were the two sons that Jacob had with his beloved wife, Rachel, right? So we had Jacob and Rachel. She was the chosen one. She was the loved one. And she had two sons. She had Joseph first, and then she had Benjamin. And if you remember the story of that, that's in Genesis chapter 35, she died while giving birth to Benjamin. So because of that, he was the youngest of Jacob's sons. Now, this is significant because if you go back to Genesis 35, I'm turning there now. So this is the context for this. This is actually one of these connections that you have to draw between the various books of scripture. This is, you call this intertextuality. This is the way the Bible interprets itself. These are the connections that you see from text to text. So this is Genesis 35, way back before everything we're covering now. But God appears to Jacob at Padan Aram, and he blesses him. He says, you know, name should no longer be Jacob. Israel shall be your name. And then he goes on to say, be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come from you. And listen to this. And kings shall come forth from you. All right. So that's Genesis 35, verse 11. Now you skip down just a few more verses, and lo and behold, guess what happens? Benjamin is born. So Rachel goes into labor, and it's severe labor. She dies as the child is born. She names him Ben-Oni, but Jacob changes his name to Benjamin. So just about 5 or 6 verses after God tells Jacob, kings shall come forth from you, Benjamin is born. Now, I think that is not just a coincidence. I think that is the background for why the very first king of Israel is from the tribe of Benjamin. So that's the Genesis 1 Samuel connection here. There's kind of a twist that happens here. So Genesis 35, which we just read, talks about kings coming forth, Benjamin is born. So it kind of makes sense. Oh, yeah, so the king is going to be from Benjamin. But what happens as the story of Genesis unfolds is that Judah, the other brother, Judah basically pledges his life in exchange for Benjamin. He puts himself forward as the one who will basically take the fall if anything happens to Benjamin. So Judah changes kind of his behavior. Early in the story of Genesis, he's not that great of a guy. He's the one who has the idea to sell Joseph into slavery, for instance. But as the story goes on in Genesis, he emerges as someone who's actually acting in a selfless sort of way. He's putting himself forward as the one who will take the place of Benjamin. He will stand in the stead of him. He will take the punishment if that's what must be done. So Judah then, after the birth of Benjamin, Judah emerges as the leader. So first Benjamin is the focus, and then Judah becomes the focus. Then you get to Genesis 49, and which of the tribes does Jacob pinpoint as the one who will hold the ruling scepter, the king's scepter? It's not Benjamin, but it's Judah. Now, amazingly, this becomes the exact same pattern that we see replicated in 1 Samuel. So first, who is the king? Well, he's the guy from the tribe of Benjamin. But then who replaces him? The man from the tribe of Judah, David, replaces him. So you have this same kind of initial expectation replaced by a change later on in focus. So what happened in Genesis is going to happen here in 1 Samuel as well. It's almost as if all of this is divinely orchestrated.
Almost
just like that. All right, well, that's a lot to say about just Benjamin, but I think it's important. It's important background for the way this story unfolds. So he comes from this particular family pedigree, and we hear his name now in verse 2. This guy, Kish in Hebrew, had a son whose name was Saul, Shaul in Hebrew. We talked about him when Samuel was born. So Shaul, the name Saul or Shaul in Hebrew, comes from the verb to ask. So the people asked for a king, right? They sha'ald for a king. So they're going to get Shaul. They're going to get the one that was asked for. So he's basically the response to their demand for a king. And he's described as a handsome young man. In the Hebrew, that's just good, tov. But tov can have these connotations of someone being attractive. So like we say, someone is good looking, right? Tov looking, handsome. He's a handsome guy. Not only handsome, but he was like more handsome than anybody else. And get this, from his shoulders and up, he was taller than any of the people. I don't know if that's something, Dan, you can identify with.
Tall and handsome? Absolutely. Tall, yeah.
But this text might resonate with you. Yeah. I mean, for those of you who've never seen Dan stands like head and shoulders higher than anybody around.
Yeah, at least the tall part. I can totally relate to the tall part.
Go for the handsome too. Tall and handsome. Yeah. So but what's interesting here is that there's a little bit of a subtlety with the word taller though. So the word tall is gavoach. And it does mean high or tall, but it also has in some context the connotation of being haughty, of being kind of prideful. So I suspect there's already kind of a little hint here, you know, as to, well, is he simply taller or is he also you know, a little bit haughty too. Now, yeah.
So he's tall and handsome and knows it.
That's it. That's precisely it. Now, what's amazing to me anyway, is as the story unfolds, is when you first encounter Saul, he kind of strikes you as just sort of a simple guy. Yeah. Like, you know, he doesn't appear haughty at all. I mean, quite the opposite. He seems like he's just, you know, he's a humble guy who's out looking for lost donkeys. That's it. You know, he's not looking for anything else. But we'll see. You know, I've mentioned this before. We've talked about this before, that anytime, and I will say that anytime that a physical description is given of a biblical character, it's going to be significant in some way. Not might be a minor way. It might be a major way. But the Bible is extremely reticent about giving us any description of even the main characters. I mean, we don't know. Was Moses short, tall? I mean, we don't have any kind of description.
I can't wait to see what all these guys look like, because you know that some of these guys are weird.
Yeah, you've got to be.
Like, you know, like, what are you going to do when you roll up and be like, what kind of a guy was Moses? And it's like, this dude's like Danny DeVito. And you're like, what? Right. Yeah. Like, no wonder Pharaoh wasn't listening to this guy.
Right. Who would listen to him?
I always thought Brad Pitt was walking in there telling you to let his people go. It's this, like, what?
Yeah, it would be like, no Charlton Heston. It's a Danny DeVito instead.
Yeah, there's no way that, you know, if you look at all the people that have played biblical characters, like, I don't think Moses probably looked like Charlton Heston. I don't think Noah looked like Russell Crowe. Moses didn't look like Christian Bale, you know?
Right.
I don't think that's probably the case. No. Saul might have looked like The Rock.
Saul might have looked like The Rock. He was a big dude. Handsome, tall. So here's how we first meet him. And I've mentioned this a couple times now. Saul's father has some donkeys. And for some reason, these donkeys got lost. Now, what do we know about donkeys? We have discussed this before, too, back in the book of Judges. Usually when we have donkeys mentioned, it's in connection with somebody who has some power, who has some authority, who has some influence. And, you know, we're told at the beginning that Saul's father, Kish, is a guy who has some influence. He's a man of wealth, a man of influence.
That's kind of important too, because I think in modern context, if you're like, and there was this guy whose father had lost his donkeys and sent his son looking for his donkeys, this is not something that you associate in modern times with, like, this guy must be, like, this must be a powerful guy.
Yeah.
That's not what you think at all. I mean, you would be like, this guy like owns donkeys? Like, it doesn't come across the same way. It's good to insert it. Like, when someone's got a bunch of donkeys, that means they got a bunch of money. That would seem like, okay, so this guy's just like a simple farmer somewhere or something. No, that's not what this means.
Yeah. It'd be like he lost a bunch of Bentleys, right?
Yes.
I had all these cars and I don't know where they went. So you got to go find them. So he's out looking for, looking for those donkeys. And he takes a servant along with him. His dad sends him out on this donkey hunt. And he goes quite a ways. He goes through the hill country of Ephraim. He goes to the land of Shalishah, doesn't find him there. He goes through there, then through the next area. Anyway, he's not finding these donkeys anywhere. I don't know if they're like tracking them or how they're doing this. Maybe they're just asking people, but these donkeys are nowhere to be found. Well, they finally come to this place called the land of Zuph. And Saul says to the servant buddy who's with him, yeah, we got to go back. Look, we've been gone long enough to where my dad is not going to be concerned about the donkeys anymore. He's going to be concerned about us. You know, we've been gone too long. So I guess we just have to give up on the donkeys and go home. But thankfully, the servant who's with him has a better idea. He says, look, Saul, there's a man of God in this city. And this man is held in honor. And everything that he says comes true. So let's go there and maybe he can tell us about the journey that we're on, and he can tell us basically where the donkeys are. So thank God this servant was with Saul, right? I mean, he was about to head home. He was about to give up on the chase. But for some reason, Saul does not know about this man of God, by the way, is Samuel. For some reason, even though Samuel's fame spread all over the country, everybody knew he was confirmed as a prophet of the Lord. Somehow Saul doesn't know this. This is another evidence that he's a little naive. Like, he doesn't kind of put things together. He's just looking for the donkeys, man. That's all he's interested in.
He seems like, too, like, maybe the servant's like, Look, I know it's all chill if you go home without these donkeys, because you are this guy's son, after all. I'd really prefer to go back with the donkeys.
Yeah. Yes. Servant's probably like, he's got a little selfish interest going on here.
Yeah. Right? It's you're not going to get disowned over this donkey business. I'd prefer not to get fired.
Right. Yeah. Well, the next verse I find humorous because Saul says, yeah, but if we go, how are we going to pay this guy? He says, if we go, what shall we bring the man? I mean, we don't have any bread in our sacks. I guess they didn't bring enough food along with them. We don't have any bread. We don't have any present to give this guy. So what are we going to do? Now, keep in mind, Saul comes from a wealthy family. I don't know if he just forgot to bring his wallet with him, but he has no money. But his servant says, I got you covered. Look, I've got a fourth of a shekel of silver here in my pocket. So we'll give that money to this man of God as a honorarium, right? I guess that was just the custom. You go see the man of God. Man of God, by the way, is basically synonymous with a prophet. That's used multiple times in the Old Testament.
Yeah.
So an Ish Elohim, man of God, is basically not what we, today we might call a really pious guy, like, oh, he's a real man of God. It's not what it means in the Old Testament. Man of God means prophet. So God's own man, the one he speaks through. So the servant, he saves the day once more. He first of all says, let's go see the prophet. Saul's broke. He says, I got you covered. I got this fourth of a shekel of silver. It'll take care of us. And then we have this parentheses in verse 9, which helps us to understand a change in terminology. It says that in times past in Israel, when someone went to inquire of God, they would say, hey, let's go and talk to the seer, the ro'eh, the one. And it's really formed from the verb to see. So just like seer. So the one who is the seer is the one who sees the will of God, or perhaps even sees the word of the Lord who tells him what response to give. So in times past, it was called a seer, but now he's called a prophet, a Navi. So a change of terminology. So that's kind of just a parenthesis added there. I mean, it actually is in parentheses in your English Bibles to clarify what was going on here. So they go see the seer, see the prophet, see the man of God. Saul said to his servant, all right, good idea, let's go. So they go into the city where the man of God was. Now they're going up to the city, they're going up the slope of the city, and they meet these young women who are coming out to the well, the city's well, to draw water. And they figure, hey, let's ask the girls. Surely they know. They say, is the seer here? Is he in town? And these girls say, yes, he is. In fact, he's ahead of you. If you hurry up, he's come to the city today because the people have a sacrifice on the high place that's going on. And he needs to be there for that. Now, just pause there for a second. This is kind of strange because when you hear the word high place in the Old Testament, I mean, if you're fairly knowledgeable about the Old Testament, you have a very negative connotation attached to that particular phraseology. A high place, bama in Hebrew, is a place that is associated throughout the book of Kings, 1st and 2nd Kings, with idolatry.
Yeah, if you were to do a, I might be wrong about this. I think I'm right about this. I'm guessing if you looked up, if you did a search on high place or high places in the Old Testament, a very large percentages of those passages would be talking about those places being torn down.
Yeah, that's precisely right. In fact, we've already encountered that, right? When the Israelites enter the land of Canaan, they're told, demolish the altars, tear down the high places,
yeah.
Burn the Asherah poles, all this kind of stuff. These were to be destroyed. So Abama, we really, honestly, we don't, this is actually one of my, I think I wrote about this in one of my devotions for Unveiling Mercy. We don't know exactly how that should best be translated, because here's the problem. Sometimes high places were in low places.
Right.
They're in a valley. So when you hear a high place, don't automatically think, oh, it was like the nearest hill or something like that. We really don't know. I mean, it was probably just kind of a technical term for a worship site. I mean, yeah, sometimes it could have been on a literally high place, like a mountain or a hill, but sometimes it wasn't. It just was a place where worship was conducted.
Yeah.
And here, I'm assuming that this worship is legitimate. I mean, Samuel's there. It's going to be, he's a prophet of Yahweh. So there's no idolatry associated with this one. It just, it's a strange word for us to hear in a positive sort of way. That's my point. So they go up to the high, the girls say he's going to be, you know, at the high place. So when you enter the city, they say, you'll find him before he goes up to the high place to eat. Evidently the people won't eat until he comes. You know, I've encountered this before back when I served as a pastor and there's a potluck. Oh. Nobody eats until the pastor shows up.
Yeah, because you got to pray,
over the food.
Dude,
yeah. No eating until pastor prays.
Let me tell you something, people. If you know a pastor or just someone who's supposed to know things about God well, don't always ask them to pray. I've been asked to pray so many times in my life. And that's not that I mind praying, but I just feel like other people should have an opportunity. I don't have access to God that you guys don't have. I don't know what it is, Chad. I mean, this is a total
aside. Food tastes better when the pastor prays.
Well, here's the thing.
That's the real reason.
There's two reasons to ask someone to pray that I can think of. I don't really like either of them. So one is that you think, well, this person's prayer is going to get heard more than some other prayer, which of course is wrong. The second is this person is obviously going to be offended if we don't ask him to say the prayer. Oh, also yes. Wrong.
This is also wrong.
And if it is, and if that's true, like then he really needs to be. You really shouldn't ask him.
Yeah, I could not agree more. That's precisely right.
I mean, Chad, do you still get asked to pray all the time?
Yes, quite frequently. Yeah. I do. Yeah.
Anyway, total aside, just a thing.
Totally aside. Yeah, but it is worth pointing out that this is a very old tradition. Because evidently back in Samuel's day, it was the same thing. People would not eat until he came because he had to bless the sacrifice and then everybody would eat. So this is the girls telling Saul and his chaplain companion how things worked in their city. So they go on up. They go to the city. They come to the city. And lo and behold, now for the first time in this chapter, we actually encounter the name of this man of God, this seer, this prophet. Of course, it's our friend Samuel, but his name does not occur in this chapter until verse 14. So they come out, they're coming into the city, and look, behold, Samuel was coming out toward them to go up to the high place. And now we have a transition. This is not in parentheses, but it's almost like a parentheses. It says, a day before Saul arrived, so he's here, we'll say, on a Friday. It's on Thursday. The Lord had revealed something to Samuel. The Lord had told him, about this time tomorrow, I'm going to send you this guy. He's from the land of Benjamin. And I want you to anoint him to Mashach. That's where we get our word Mashiach, which comes in English as Messiah. So you are to Messiah him, anoint him to be prince over my people Israel. And he shall deliver my people from the hand of the Philistines, for I have regarded my people because their cry has come to me. Now, this is one of these situations where you would expect God to tell Samuel, you shall anoint him to be king over my people Israel. But it's not. The word for king is melech. The word that's translated here is prince is nagid. It's used in a lot of different contexts. And it's not really... I don't want you to get the idea that it's like somehow lower than a king, because it turns out David himself is referred to as a Nagid multiple times, even though David was clearly a king. So one commentator that I'm reading as we go along with this suggested that this would be translated. It sounds kind of funny when you say it, but he suggested this be translated something like highness, which just sounds extremely British to me.
Yes.
Yeah. So he said it'd be something like that. It's just kind of it's a term of respect that designates a leader. So prince, you know, we have certain connotations connected with the word prince, and we usually think of a prince as someone who's below a king. Not so. This should be not this particular prince, not this Nagid. So he's going to be basically, maybe we should just translate it as leader. That's probably the best way to do this. He shall be leader over my people Israel. And God clarifies what he is to do as the leader. He's going to deliver my people from the hand of the Philistines because God has regarded his people and heard their cry. So God is, as we talked about in the last episode, God is accommodating the request of his people for a king, just like he accommodates other things. He accommodates the temple when David wants to build a temple and Solomon ends up doing it. There is, when you read through the scriptures, there is this sense of God basically in many situations kind of going along with his people, right? Yeah, they make some stupid decisions. They make some bad innovations. And God seems to just be able to adapt, to use that for, I mean, sometimes for some extremely impressive goals of his, like the whole temple, for instance.
Yeah, it kind of seems to me, Chad, that on one hand, Saul seems like an obvious choice, right? Because of like he's, you know, big, tall, handsome dude that is a good warrior, all the things, like a bunch of things that you know that the people are like, yeah, for sure, love it. What is also true is that, like, I mean, God is the one that ultimately picks him. Now, he picks someone that the people will be in it. If he had picked David at this point, I for sure people would have been like, what?
No way. Like, ain't happening. Put that kid back out there with the sheep.
Yeah.
We don't need him.
That is not the guy. So I think there's a couple of things going on here. One is that God is choosing somebody that he knows the people, that he's choosing the type of person that the people are desiring. And two, it seems that this sort of doing this bent, like this Judah, coming in for Benjamin move that was already done. I mean, it seems like this is not just like, oh, this is like kind of cool they did this, but this was like very intentional.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. So intentional. He's like, I'm going to choose a Benjamite and then I'm going to like replace him with a guy from a guy from Judah. Like, that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That does seem to be, I mean, it's just like, it's too easy almost. Like Saul is like too easy a choice, right? Yeah. It's like, yeah, it's just not the way that God usually works. You know, God is typically picking someone that you wouldn't expect him to pick. But you see Saul and you're like, oh yeah, that guy's like an obvious choice.
Yeah. Part of it, this sort of reversal thing that God did before, he's going to do again. But it seems that part of this too is God saying, you know, before I go get my guy, I'm gonna, like, you're not going to accept this guy. You're not going to accept my guy, right? What I'm going to have to do is choose the guy that you would, that you're going to have a unanimous applause for, then I'm going to replace that guy.
Yeah, right. You know, this crossed my mind when we were talking about this. It's kind of the opposite when you get to the New Testament, right?
Yeah.
Because, Saul / Paul, he becomes the preeminent, really, I mean, he becomes the preeminent apostle. It's pretty hard to argue otherwise afterward, right? So yeah. You have the regular apostles, the Davids, if you will, and then you have Saul after that, who rises to
prominence. And I know this is a debate. This is a controversial thing. I've argued this with many people, but Paul was God's guy, so much so that I think even when they were like, we got to replace Judas, God was like, I didn't tell you to do that.
Just like, wait a little bit. I've got somebody in mind already.
Someone in mind. You're, trust me, he's not on your ballot.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I'm going to pick somebody that you would never, ever have suspected. He's studying at the feet of Gamaliel right now, in fact.
Yes. So I am of the opinion that the apostles jumped the gun on that replacing the disciple thing. I mean, after all, Jesus did tell them, I know this is a total aside, but we're talking about kings and replacing stuff. Go to Jerusalem, don't do anything until the Spirit comes. And they're like, by anything, do you mean add an apostle? Like, I don't know about you, Chad. That seems like a thing.
Seems like a pretty major decision to me.
Seems like something you might want to wait for the Holy Spirit to be involved in.
Nah, just draw lots. That's all you need to do.
We're like, let's roll some dice. Like, what are we doing? We're kind of bored. We can't do anything until the Holy Spirit arrives, so... What do you say we like roll dice and choose an apostle?
Seems like a good choice.
it's a very disciple move.
Yeah. So I'm sure if somebody wants to hear more of your arguments there, they can just go to, you guys covered Acts, right?
Yep. Oh, yeah, it's in there. Yeah, you can hear my full-blown argument for this.
All right, cool. All right, so what happens here? So Samuel saw Saul. And the Lord said to him, that's your guy. That's the man of whom I spoke to you. This one shall, and then we have a little translation issue. My translation has, this one shall rule over my people. And ESV has, this is the one who will restrain my people. It's very different, you know. So I looked it up. The verb is atzar. If it does mean rule, this is the only place in the Old Testament where it would have that meaning. Most of the time it means, like the ESV has it, restrain, hold back, rein in, you might say. So it's a very different kind of connotation. So this is the guy. He's going to be the Nagid. He's going to be the leader of the prince. And he's the one who's going to kind of hold back, restrain, rein in my people. Now, that could be one of the duties of a ruler, but it is an interesting choice of words. So Saul approaches Samuel, and Saul is still clueless. He's like, hey, could you tell me where the seer's house is? And Samuel says, you're looking at the seer. I am the seer. I'm the guy.
You're seeing the seer right now.
The seer right now. He says, go up to the high place, and I want you to eat with me today. Almost sounds like Jesus and Zacchaeus, right? I'm gonna have a meal at your house today. So you're going to eat with me today. And in the morning, this is some strange language. I'm going to tell you everything that's on your mind. By this point, Saul is probably thinking, whoa, what is going on
here? Yeah, also, just in case, also, Saul's like, wait a minute. I obviously don't know who the seer is. So anybody could say that they were the seer, and I wouldn't know. Now you're telling me that I have to come spend the night at your house. But then Samuel's going to drop some knowledge on him right here. He's like, okay, yeah, you're definitely the seer.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, oh, by the way, you know, those donkeys that you've been looking for days, they're fine.
Yeah, that's when you know
they've already been found.
And that's when you know you're dealing with the seer. Like, they ain't no mention of donkeys before this.
Yeah, I didn't say anything about donkeys. How'd you know that? And then he has this. This is the way he closes it out. And for whom is all that is desirable in Israel? Is it not for you and for all your father's household? That's some kind of odd language there. So, you know, what's he talking about? Well, Saul evidently understands the implications of that. Like, he's the one whom Israel is going to desire to be a ruler, because here's how Saul responds to this. It's very Gideon-like. He says, me? Listen, I'm a Benjamite. I'm like from the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family is the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin. So why are you talking to me like this? Why are you speaking to me in this way? So he doesn't answer him right away. He doesn't like give him a response that's going to actually answer that kind of question. But he goes on to say this. The story goes on to say this. So Samuel takes Saul and his servant. He brings him into this hall. He puts him at the head of the table. There's 30 other guys there. It's just a big feast. So Saul keeps moving up, right? He goes into the city. Now he goes up, and now he's up to the head of the table. Pretty soon he's going to be on a roof. Samuel tells the cook, hey, you know what? That special portion, that leg portion with all the meat on it that I told you to set aside, bring it. So the cook brings it out. He puts this big leg of meat on the table in front of Saul. Samuel says, I saved this for you, and I've kept it for the appointed time. So he eats this delicious cut of meat. And then that night he brings him back to his place, and he has him stay on the roof of his house. So we have to stop there, because we're up there 40 minutes, but this is all setting up for what's going to happen next. It's kind of a strange chapter break here, but we're going to find out next time what Saul is going to do to what Samuel's going to do to let Saul know that he is actually the one that the Lord has chosen. But this is a great sermon. This is one of those where as one commentator put it, it's like a guy who's like looking for a penny and finds buried treasure. Yeah. He's on a donkey hunt and he finds a kingdom instead. So pretty fascinating chapter, pretty fascinating, just kind of a literary lead in to let us know about, what kind of guy Saul is, and how Samuel's going to bring him into this new vocation of being the ruler of Israel.
Yeah, well, right on. Yeah, it's a fascinating story. And this episode will be forever known as The Rock on a Donkey Hunt, which is I think it's probably one of the best titles that we've done. So
that's perfect.
That's good. Yeah, join us next week as we find out how this Anointing King action goes down. Also, you got to pre-order that Unveiling Mercy, that 365-day devotional through the Hebrew language. You got to get that. Pre-order it. It is available now. Link I will put in the show notes, or you can just go to Amazon and type it in the search bar, and you will be able to pre-order it. Chad, I'll see you next week.
All right. See you then.